logistical questions, housekeeping questions from the syllabus or otherwise about what we're doing, how we're going to do it. I made these CDs, and a lot of you got them. I apparently didn't make quite enough, and apparently there's also a problem with Chapter 1. How many people tried to print out Chapter 1 and couldn't? How recently? Okay. When did I fix it? I think I fixed it last night. There's some goofy thing. All the rest of the chapters, sort of Murphy's Law, whatever, can go wrong, will go wrong. All the rest of the chapters were fine, but for some reason, Chapter 1, when I put it in this PDF format, I could read it, but when other people tried to download it, it wouldn't open. But I fixed that, I think. So you now should be able to go on the website. I also have a couple of discs that I just made, and I would appreciate it. What I think I will do is send around a disc where you can just copy off chapter, if you need chapter one, copy chapter one. Or if you want to just copy chapter one, and I'll get you the rest. I've got about five more discs. And as I said, my advice to you, if you have a laptop or if you have a computer at home that you use for study, just copy the whole thing, except if you're worried about how much space, it's the total disk is about 450 megabytes, something like that. And on a standard, 20 gigabyte hard drive, that's not a whole lot. Most of that is all the MP3 files. If you want to save space, you can delete or not copy all the MP3 files, and then you're down to about, 100 megabytes or 50 megabytes or something like that. It's not all that much. And it'll have the complete text. It'll have all the past exams. It'll have all kinds of stuff that's helpful. So, but what I would do is just copy that onto whatever computer you regularly use, whether it's your laptop or whatever, and then put the disk in storage someplace, so if your computer crashes or whatever, you should be able to get it again. So if you desperately need Chapter 1 and you haven't been able to download it from the website, you should be able to do that now. But if you need to do that, go ahead and take this disk as it's passing around and just copy that file onto your laptop. Any questions about? We're going to start actually doing Chapter 1 tomorrow. That's the inconvenient thing. So if I can, that's why I want to get the physical pages printed out. The first 30 pages printed out as quickly as possible, and then if you have some other way to get at it, all the better. Any other kind of housekeeping questions about what we do or how we do it, or that's on the safe side. I mean, most of the time you can get away with a lot less than that. I mean, today we'll do actually quite a few pages, I hope. But starting tomorrow we're going to move, maybe 5 pages. There'll be days when we do 3 pages. There'll be days when we do 5 or 6 pages. But there will be days when we do, 12 or 18 pages. So I would stay 20 pages ahead of where we last left off, just to be on the safe side. The other reason I recommend that is to sort of read it in chunks, read a section so that you sort of get the big picture and you can kind of, as you're doing your notes, tie it together, rather than be just far enough so that you won't be caught unprepared for class the next day, but you're not quite seeing where it's all headed. So better to err on the side of being farther ahead than you need to be than wind up short. I don't have a reading list where I say, well, tomorrow we're going to be here and the day after that we're going to be there. I just go at whatever pace. Some days we're I'm full of digressions, and we won't go very fast. And other days, we seem to just, it clicks together, and we're ready to move. So, other logistical questions? Feel free to raise those or respond by email to me. If you don't want me to, actually, I'll take your name off anyway, but frequently when somebody asks a question, instead of just responding to that person, I will take the question and then send it to everybody. I'll take your name off so it doesn't say question from John Doe, but it'll say, here's a question somebody asked and here's my answer to the question, because oftentimes you'll have the same kind of question. So if you want it to be private and you don't want anybody else to even know that the question was asked, say this is, for your eyes only. But otherwise, if it's a question like, why did the court do this, or what does this mean, or something like that, I usually try to tell everybody. Other questions? Okay, well, let's plunge into the assignment here. The other thing is, did you all get these little name card shingle type things? They didn't hand those out to you? Okay. Oftentimes that happens during orientation. I will actually make you, and I think you may have seen in the syllabus. Oh, and I didn't give you attendance sheets either. I'll bring all that stuff tomorrow. There are these little sort of placard things that have your name on it, and that way I can learn your names more easily. But I'll bring all those tomorrow. Okay, well, the assignment that I gave you was to read the stuff in the introduction and look at the problem on page 4, which asks you to read the following cases in order to answer the question. There are actually two questions here. So the first thing that we're going to do is essentially read or talk about these two cases, Railroad Company versus Stout and Britt versus the chemical company versus Britt. And then we'll come back and try to answer the questions that are on page 4. Sound okay? I've actually looked at I get an Excel spreadsheet that has all of your pictures on it, so I'm starting to try to learn your names, but I'm not doing too well. Actually, this is very mean. Is it Ms. Riseborough? It is. Are you related to John?
I am.
Okay, good. John was a very good friend of mine, so it sort of reminds me what an old geezer I am that I'm now teaching my friend's students. But in any event, would you mind telling me, have you read the turntable case?
I have read only part of the turntable.
Okay. Well, why don't you get us started at least? Since I picked on you, you can help me get somewhere with it, and then I'll turn to somebody else when you're running out of steam. Oh, good. Okay. Well, I actually grew up in a railroad town, as it turns out, and they used to have these so-called roundhouses where they'd store the locomotives, and the turntable was designed so they could go get different locomotives and then put them back on the track and connect them and bring them in and service them and do stuff like that. So it was like a gigantic merry-go-round in a way, obviously very heavy so it could accommodate locomotives, but also designed so it could be turned by hand. And that's the reason it causes all these problems. Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. And I want to actually pull us back to a sort of wider angle focus here to say, what are we reading here? What is this thing that we're reading? Yeah, it is a case, but what is it? How does it relate to these facts? Or, you know, again, the sort of wide angle, big picture question here. We're reading an opinion, right? Written by, or what court is this in? So far as you can tell. Okay, it's actually. The case we're reading is actually a Supreme Court case. And it is, the first paragraph says, now the reason, and again, this is all the stuff we're learning here, the way you can tell what kind of a court it is by looking at the citation, which is immediately below the name of the case. So here at the top of page 5 in the left-hand column, very top, it says Railroad Company versus Stout. It says 84 U.S. The 84 is the volume number. That's a line of books going across the shelf, and they just start numbering them. And when they're full with one book, they start another one, and the next one would be 85. And the idea is that you could find in the record of the Supreme Court opinions, you could find volume 84. And then there's actually this parenthetical which has to do with a particular reporter, a guy named Wallace. And then a page number, 657. So if you went up in the library and found the old U.S. Supreme Court reports, by this time they're old and moldy, and you found volume 84 and you turn to page 657, there you would find this particular case. So it's a U.S. Supreme Court opinion, but what's your understanding of that first paragraph here, error to the Circuit Court for the District of Nebraska? What's your sense as to what that means? What is that referring to, or what's going on? What's the court doing here? Yes, sir. Okay, the loser of this case is appealing to the Supreme Court to try to get a different result. Obviously, in a case, when a case gets tried to a jury, we rarely read a case where we're actually looking at a transcript of a jury case. What we're looking at typically is an appellate court opinion. We're looking at a decision made by a court of appeals, in this case, the very top of the food chain, the U.S. Supreme Court, where they're reviewing what has been done either by a trial court or by an appellate court below them to try to figure out was there some kind of error that was committed that would justify reversing the judgment and imposing a new judgment. So as far as you can tell in this case, who was the loser who's trying to get a different outcome? Is it Mr. Camo? See? Go ahead. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so the defendant was the loser below, and it's now the defendant who's complaining that something went wrong, something went terribly wrong, that justifies them in getting a different outcome. And that's typically the name of the game in all of these appellate court opinions. The loser comes to the court saying, I think a terrible mistake has been made. Here's the mistake. You can't simply impose the judgment that was rendered by the court below. You've got to put together a different, there's got to be a different outcome to this case. Now, in this case, the railroad was the loser, and they actually, this is a relatively nice opinion in that the reasons they give for asking the court to reverse the case are relatively clearly laid out. Sometimes you have to go hunting like an archaeologist through the opinion, trying to figure out where in the heck, what is it that is going on here? What are they really, what's the issue at stake? So as you prepare your brief, your written brief of the case, trying to summarize the case so that you'll be prepared for class, you're going through to try to figure out, well, what is it that the losing party was arguing, and then what did the court say in response to those arguments? I saw some hands raised. Mr. Phillips, I believe? Yeah. You don't know what that means, right? I mean, that's why you're here, isn't it? So you're trying to figure this out, and I will use this little moment here to illustrate a very important principle throughout your legal career, which is one of the greatest attributes you can have is knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know. As the saying goes, it's not what you don't know that hurts you, it's what you think you know that you don't know. That's what gets you in trouble. And I remember when I first started practicing law many years ago, and I would watch these very senior lawyers who I wanted to grow up and be like, and they asked what I thought were, they had the courage to ask these really sort of stupid questions. They just start out with these kinds of very basic questions. I always wanted to look like I knew what I was doing. They had the luxury that they were well established. Everybody knew they were successful, smart lawyers. I was the new kid on the block, so I couldn't afford to walk in and start saying, "Well, what about this? And what are you really saying here? And are you saying this?" And so forth. So again, one of the things that happens, particularly in the first week of law school, is that you have this. You feel like you're standing in front of Niagara Falls with a Dixie cup. As this, wave of stuff is going past you, and you kind of go around saying, well, gee, this seems to, I bet this is this, and you have to kind of make hunches and guesses and suppositions, and some of them turn out to be correct, and some of them turn out to be wrong. And again, one of the things that's very, you have to start sort of making some assumptions, well, I bet this is this, and I bet that is that, because then these things would line up and it would make sense. But you have to remember, but I don't really know that. I could be wrong about that. And it's very easy, having made a logical assumption, that you forget it's just an assumption, and when things start not adding up, you've forgotten the fact that you were guessing about that, and it's become a verity in your mind. So, again, this error to the Circuit Court for the District of Nebraska, this case was apparently tried in Nebraska in the District Court. There was a judge, there was a jury, there was a judgment. And now there is an error proceeding. And somebody's saying, again, appeals are all about alleged errors, where the losing party says there's been an error, and of course the winning party says no error at all. Looks perfectly fine to me. And the question for the appellate court is to figure out who's got the better of the argument. Does the losing party have a good argument to say that there was an error here, or does the winning party have a good explanation for why things were done the way they were, and therefore we should let the decision stand? Okay, the other thing about this opinion is that you get sort of a long prologue before you ever get to the opinion of the court. So it's written more like a newspaper account. That was the first kind of actual case reports. And when you look at the names of the books that contain the opinions of the court, you find things like the Supreme Court Reporter, or the Pacific Reporter, or the Federal Reporter. And in fact, the name is sort of like a newspaper reporter. The connection there is actually not inaccurate, because originally there were just people that went to court and kind of wrote down what the judges were saying and then made sort of historical, or, they kind of kept these files so that in subsequent cases you could go back and say, well, wasn't there a case like that in front of Judge Schmo? And what did Judge Schmo say about that? And maybe we can use that as a precedent in some future case. So, again, in the beginning of this, you have, in effect, a sort of journalistic account of what happened in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it isn't until the bottom of page 6 in the left-hand column that you get Mr. Justice Hunt delivering the opinion of the court. Now we find out, in effect, what the answer was. But earlier, for example, on that same page, on page 6 in the left-hand column, about 6 lines from the top, it says, Mr. Isaac Cook for the plaintiff in error. Who's the plaintiff in error? The railroad is the moving party here. They are the plaintiff, the one who is complaining. They're not in error in the sense that they're wrong, but they're the moving party in the error proceeding. So again, we're kind of puzzling our way through this, sort of like filling in things in a crossword puzzle where, yeah, it's a 6-letter word and the 4th letter is G, and here's the description of it, here's a word that fits. So as we look at these things, we kind of figure out, this must be this and that must be that. Okay, now, what are the, as I said earlier, the railroad actually has 3 different arguments that they're trying to sell as to why this judgment was wrongly entered and why they should get a new lease on life. But actually, before that, you had a question. Okay. Great. And your name, I'm sorry? Stephanie. And it's Williams. Yes, okay. Go ahead. Because the case was originally brought in federal court, and one of the enjoyable subjects you will have in your civil procedure class, do you all have civil procedure just before this? No. How many of you had Jerry Hess an hour ago? Okay, so about a third of you. All right. And then the rest of you have civil procedure idiom. Okay. But in one of the things in civil procedures, how do you get into federal court? I think you'll actually wind up doing that the second semester. The first semester you do the rules, and it turned out last year I taught civil procedures second semester. So I did the stuff on how do you get federal jurisdiction. And one of the ways you get it is through something called diversity, where the parties are of diverse citizenship, and there's a whole rigmarole. It's complicated. It's a classical sort of technical area of law. It's not, a real culture war kind of clash between, different philosophies of life. It's a, the question about whether you're properly in federal court is classic lawyer kind of stuff. But in any event, you can file a case in federal court if you meet certain kinds of qualifications. Once it's in federal court, it goes up through the federal food chain. If it starts out in state court, it goes up through the state food chain to the highest state court, and then it may go to the U.S. Supreme Court if there's some federal or constitutional issue. Right. Actually, again, the federal food chain goes up from the district courts. So there's a federal district court. There's one over there about a mile and a half away in the federal building. There's one in the Western District of Washington and so forth. From these federal district courts, you go up in this region. We go to the Ninth Circuit and from there to the Supreme Court. So again, each system follows its own kind of trajectory. Okay, so the question, again, before the House is, what's the railroad's argument as to why they deserve a new lease on life, what went wrong with this case in the trial court? Yes, sir. Your name?
Joe Harris.
Mr. Harris. Okay, go ahead.
The
Okay, let's pause there. Let's take these one at a time here. So the first argument is that the child was at fault. Now, as it turns out, we're not trying to actually learn the substantive law here per se. We'll come back to these issues later on, issues like contributory negligence, issues like premises liability, and so forth. But just so you know, the rule at this time was that a plaintiff who was himself or herself at fault, negligent in causing their own injury, was barred from recovery. The modern rule, as we'll see in Chapter 5, is a comparative reduction. But here, the rule was a plaintiff who was at fault for, in this case, his own injury, couldn't recover. Partly at fault in the sense that the child's negligence combined with the railroad's negligence produced the injury. So the first argument the railroad makes is we were denied justice in this case because this accident resulted not only from our alleged negligence, but it also resulted from the child's negligence. And that was never considered by the jury. What's the court's response to that argument? Is the railroad right in complaining about this, or is the railroad wrong in complaining about this, Mr. Harris?
Well, they don't really say the railroad's right or wrong. I mean, it just doesn't apply to this case. In the first part, they argue that the parents were liable.
I'm not sure they rely on it being the parents' fault. But there's a different reason why the railroad loses on this point. Yes, ma'am. The railroad explicitly disclaimed that argument. In a way, it's sort of odd that they're bringing it up now, but it's actually a very important principle of appellate procedure, that one of the things that you cannot do in an appeal is complain about an issue you didn't raise or properly perfect in the trial court. You have to make it easy for the trial judge to do the right thing. You can't complain that the trial judge did the wrong thing unless you were at every step of the way urging the trial court to do the right thing and it was over your objection that the trial judge did the wrong thing. Now here, the railroad apparently abandoned that argument, didn't make it, didn't assert it. Now, in fairness to what Mr. Harris was saying earlier, there is language in the opinion where they're saying, well, gee, the standard for a child, blah, 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 blah. They sort of go to the merits of it. They say, well, we're not really, wait a minute, we don't really even want to talk about that because the railroad explicitly disclaimed this. Why? Why would the railroad not use a potentially saving argument? Yes, ma'am. Your name? Yes. Ms. Lamb, is that it? Ma, thank you. Well, you mean this child wasn't negligent as a matter of law? He's 6 years old, right? Now, the modern rule also on this is that children below the age of 7 are typically judged incapable of contributory negligence, but as a matter of fact, a 6-year-old does know the difference between where they're supposed to be and they're not supposed to be. I would bet you that if you took this child's deposition and asked him, you know, well, did you talk to your friends about this? Oh, yeah, my friend said we shouldn't do this. You know, he pointed out the no trespassing sign or whatever, and my mommy told me this, and so forth and so on, and the child perhaps was well aware that they were someplace they were not supposed to be. Mr. Phillips? But remember, the railroad's in the business from day one of saying, we don't want to pay this guy a dime. You know, to the extent that they want to be everybody's pal, they would roll over and play dead. They're not going to roll over and play dead. They're going to use every advantage they can get to try to keep this boy from recovering. True. But everything they do in terms of arguing the amount of damages, in terms of asserting the fact that the railroad's not at fault, questioning proximate cause, every other cross-examination of every witness is going to remind the jury the railroad's job here is to try to prevent the plaintiff from recovering. Why did they not rely on the plaintiff's fault as a way of recovering? The strategy of the railroad is, you know, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. If our primary strategy here, we could either say, look, there are plenty of people to blame here, and one of the people to blame is the child. Yeah, sure, we were negligent, but so was he. Their strategy was just the opposite, to say, nobody was, you know, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes people get hurt and it's nobody's fault. There are accidents in this world, and this was one of them. Terribly tragic, gee, we're so sorry for this boy, but you know, the law doesn't make you pay for somebody's injury just because a bad thing happened. It only makes you pay for something when it's your fault, and let's look at the evidence here. This really wasn't our fault. They could hardly make that kind of lowering the temperature argument when they turn around in full righteous indignation about this 6-year-old boy. So it's getting the things lined up. It's not that the railroad's afraid of appearing unsympathetic to the jury. The railroad's afraid of looking like they're hypocrites here. They can't very well argue their own lack of negligence and at the same time be full of moral indignation about the kid. It's actually not theoretically inconceivable, but it's practically inconceivable. Again, the railroad made a practical, strategic judgment, and lawyers do this all the time. Lawyers have to decide, what's my strategy here? Do I call this witness? Do I make this argument? Do I take juror number 6? Or do I try to strike juror number 6? You make strategic judgments in which you try to get advantages. And oftentimes the advantages mean that you got to throw something else overboard. And I would expect that the lawyer didn't just do this on his own. He, I'm assuming it's a he at this time in history, that lawyer would have consulted with the railroad and say, hey, this is our strategy, and get the client to approve of it. Clients are much happier when they are made part of the decision-making process than when the lawyer goes off pursuing what may be a sensible strategy, but again, most people like to be a part of the decision-making process. Okay, so the first argument doesn't work because they say the child, well, because the railroad decided to not even use that argument. What's the second pitch that they're making on appeal here? Yes, sir. Your name? Mr. Sharman, yeah. Okay. So this argument essentially is that the railroad wasn't at fault. Now, this is an important place to recognize the difference between what goes on in an appellate court and what goes on in the trial court. What is the question in the trial court? When it's put to the jury, what does the jury have to decide? Mr. Sharma? Okay. Was the railroad at fault? What is the burden of... By what level of conviction or certainty does the jury have to make that finding? That's in a criminal case. Before the state can put you in jail, you have to be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. But if the state, but if she wants to take away your money, the only thing she has to prove to a jury is that she's met her burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. So the jury is asked, you find by a preponderance of the evidence, more probably than not, that you were negligent, that your negligence caused the injury, and that these are your damages. What's the standard in the appellate court? What is the question before the U.S. Supreme Court as to whether or not they should reverse this case? Yes. Ms. Ma, right? Yeah. Okay, but how could there be an error here? How would there be an error that would justify reversing this case if they could have wrong instructions to the jury? But that, as it turns out, is not one of their arguments. The argument here is that there is no negligence on the part of the railroad. In effect, that, yes. Yes, was there evidence of negligence? They're essentially saying there was no evidence of negligence here. What does the court say in response to that argument? Well, the kid gets injured by it. That shows that it's dangerous. But what shows that the railroad was negligent? What was the evidence, as you recall, going back to Ms. Riseborough's description of the facts here, what did we hear about the railroad that went to the question of their negligence? What did they do that was negligent? Yes, ma'am. Okay. Yeah, and we actually pick up that whole question about the relevance of that little piece of evidence about the way other people do the same kind of thing, the bearing that that evidence has on the question of negligence. But one of the things was they recognized the need to keep this locked. They had some kind of latching mechanism, but they'd allowed that to get broken and they didn't repair it so that kids could come along and turn this thing. There's another piece of evidence that helps us, Mr. Sharma. Yes, the workers had seen the kids before. So if this were out in the middle of nowhere, which is obviously one of the issues we get to in the Britt case, if this had been a place where nobody had any clue that kids would be anywhere near there, well, you could leave dangerous stuff lying around and not be found at fault. But where you know that kids are around here playing, where you recognize the potential for this thing to look like something to play on, and you know that this thing is, in fact, a very heavy machine that acts like a Cuisinart when you stick your foot into it, that's what made them negligent. So the court says, we find that there was evidence that the railroad did not use reasonable care, and there was a basis for finding them negligent. Now, there's a third argument. Yes, sir. You're Mr. Fowler. Okay, they're saying there's a third kind of error here that it never should have been given to the jury. This was a question that should have been decided by the judge. And the railroad argues that the place for a jury is where you dispute issues of fact, but when it comes to questions about whether somebody was negligent, that's really an issue of law that belonged to the judge, and it was an error for the judge to give a question of law to the jury. How does the court respond to that argument? Yeah.
Well, they say that in certain cases, that is correct, but they went to precedent and they mentioned about 500 cases where in this situation that the facts were undisputed, but that they let in the trial was injured and they let it go to the jury.
What is the function of a jury?
To determine questions of fact.
Okay. But there's more than that. Yes, sir. Yeah, sorry. Okay. And the court actually, you know, sings a little hymn of praise here to the jury system to say what's so great. Why do we like juries? Why do we do this sort of ritualistic thing here? Yes, ma'am. Okay, you have this collective wisdom. It's not just the individual experience of you or you or you, which might be shaped by, you know, that we all have our own little life stories and things that make us believe certain things and not believe other things. But when we put 12 of us together, we get a better kind of balance to reduce the likelihood that individual quirks are going to decide somebody's fate, and it will be something that's more shared, a sort of shared wisdom of the community. It also, of course, the jury is connected with a kind of democratic belief here, that the government is not some foreign tyranny. The government is us. We are the ones who make the laws. We are the ones who, at these critical junctures, enforce the laws. They come from us, and therefore, when we read about people being held liable for this or thrown in jail or what have you, we don't think of that as some occupying power. We say, well, that was people like you and me who were on juries that made these kinds of decisions. So the court is saying it's a good thing that the judge gives these questions to the jury. Even where the facts are undisputed, the application of the principle about what is reasonable care is one we want juries to make rather than having that come from some, you know, bureaucrat, in effect. Now, the court does recognize that there are cases when you take a case away from a jury. When is that? When is it that you say it would be wrong to give this question to a jury? This is one I should decide as a judge on my own. The court gives some examples. Mr. Camo? Right, where reasonable minds could reach only one conclusion. Where you say, and the court gives an example of, suppose you have an accident with a carriage, and the carriage goes over the edge because it's the guy was driving way too fast and too close to the edge. You look at the facts of that and you say, gee, a reasonable person couldn't reach any other conclusion but to find the defendant was negligent. If I have a case like that as a judge, I don't give that to the jury because reasonable minds couldn't differ about the outcome. And similarly, in a mirror image of that, if the accident happens because there was some hidden flaw in the harness that couldn't have been discovered through reasonable inspection, and it suddenly gave way and the thing went over the edge, well, we couldn't fairly call the defendant negligent there either. Reasonable minds could only reach the conclusion this was an accident without anybody's fault. But to the extent that the cases typically don't wind up at these extremes, where we say judgment for the defendant because there's so little evidence, or judgment for the plaintiff because the evidence against the defendant is so overwhelming, most cases wind up in this middle ground where we say, you know, the evidence is such that a reasonable person could find there was negligence or a reasonable person could find the opposite. And in those cases, we say it's for the jury to make the ultimate call. Ms. Ma. Yes. No. Typically, when you find findings of fact and conclusions of law, that will be what we call a bench trial, where the judge operates as the finder of fact. What happens when you have a jury is that you have typically a verdict form. In fact, at the end of the book, it's when you finally get the book, or if you want to look at it sooner, you can find it online. It's in the appendix, and I have, I think it's appendix C, actually. No, I forget which one. I think it's the first one, appendix A. In any event, I give you a typical sort of scenario for a simplified case and walk you through kind of some of the procedural terms, and at the end of it I give you a typical verdict form, and oftentimes you will get the case submitted to the jury with a verdict form where you fill this thing out, and it'll ask you questions in a kind of sequential way. Do you find the defendant was negligent? Do you find this negligence proximately caused the injury? Do you find the plaintiff was negligent, et cetera, et cetera? The questions that are raised in the case, and the jury can sort of indicate how they come out on these questions, and it will then instruct them, okay, if you answer yes to this question, then go on and do this, but if you say no, then drop down to this line and sign it and turn it in. So again, the jury is typically directed to get a answers to limited set of questions, and then it will produce some kind of a judgment. Okay, so the court again said, wrong railroad, you lose on each of those arguments. We find nothing wrong with the procedure that occurred below. The decision stands. Now, obviously, in the next case, we get the opposite. The court rules in favor of the appellant, finds a reason to reverse it. We'll obviously have to pick that up tomorrow. As I say, I will get you a copy of the first 30 pages of Chapter 1, just so you'll have plenty to chew on before the books I assume will arrive on Friday. If you need to go farther, you can print out more from what's online. Did the disc make its way around? I'll print out some more, or I'll how many people need a disc? Okay, I'm going to be making some more discs. When you come up later this afternoon up to the fourth floor to pick up the handout, you can also get a disc if you need one. Any other questions before we quit for today? We'll pick up, obviously, with the Britt case, and then we'll move on to Chapter 1 tomorrow. Good. We'll see you then. Yeah.
On the third issue, it was denied because although it was facts were undisputed,
yeah,
one reasonable person couldn't come to the conclusion.
Well, the reason that the railroad lost the third argument was because the court said it was a right thing to give it to the jury. A jury could, on these facts, have said, you know, the railroad was negligent, or the jury could have said, no, the railroad wasn't negligent. They didn't have enough knowledge that kids played there, or what they did in terms of this latch was enough, or they tried to shoo them away, or whatever. But it wasn't something where the plaintiff, you know, had to win, or more to the point, it wasn't something where the defendant had to win. It was a question where reasonable minds could differ, and therefore
they could, so it was okay.
Right to give it to the jury.
Okay, great.
You bet.